when you see or you have heard this week about the sort of monstrous barbarity that happened, you inevitably start to wonder what can account for that kind of cold-blooded, calculated barbarity. And you might be tempted to think that it is the consequence of the last 15 or 20 years or so of geopolitical posturing. But when you step back a little bit and you look at history, you realize that what we have witnessed this week is in some sense the consequence of 300 years of history of Western Europe and the Western world seeking to find footholds in the regions of Afghanistan and Syria and Pakistan and India. In fact, just as one example, the British occupied India as far long ago as 1757. And because they had become concerned that the Russians were going to try to invade India, the land that they held as a colonial possession, the reason that they were concerned about the Russians entering into India through Afghanistan, the English invade Afghanistan, take over Kabul, and install a pro-British Shah. And that lasts for about 3 years. And by 1842, the English garrisons have been overrun, and they know that they only have one option, and that is to leave the country. And so on January 1st, 1842, 16,000 Englishmen and both of soldiers and military personnel and support personnel and even Indian soldiers left Kabul to evacuate the country. But they were so unaware of the gorges and the passes that went along the Kabul River, so unfamiliar with the territory, so unprepared to face an enemy and to walk through frozen hinterland, that they were ambushed by Afghani warriors, and of 16,000 people, 7 survived, 6 of whom were imprisoned, and only 1 was permitted to escape, if only to tell the story of what had happened. And his picture is on the painting on the front of your bulletin. He was an assistant surgeon by the name of Dr. William Bryden. And of 16,000, he was the only one to make it to the British garrison in Jalalabad. What a story. They weren't aware of the battlefield that they were on. And according to my friend from West Point, who actually happens to be here today, it's chalked up as one of the more colossal military blunders in history. Totally unaware of their surroundings, totally unprepared to meet that which was before them. Last week, we started a series on Paul's letter to the church at Galatia, and we, from his introduction, deduced that he had one overarching theme for the whole letter, and that was this. There is a campaign that you might be tempted to fight that will be ultimately futile. And that campaign is to obtain on your own strength the favor of God. But that there was another campaign that was ultimately necessary if you're in Jesus. And that is the fight to be faithful in response to the favor that's been bought you in Jesus. That's your campaign. That's the right campaign. Last week we established that there is a campaign to be fought. This week, we're going to look at Paul's words, and we're going to establish, if you will, the fields upon which that fight is taken. 3 fields, if you will. 3 fields that if you're not aware of the field, or why you need the grace of God to go into them, the battle is already lost. And those 3 fields are this: the field of man, the field of metrics, and the field of meaning. The field of man, the field of metrics, the field of meaning. We're in Galatians. We're in chapter 1. We'll start in verse 10. Will you stand, please? Galatians chapter 1, starting in verse 10. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. For I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. For I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. For you've heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. And I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. But when he who had set me apart before I was born and who called me by his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus. And then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days. But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. In what I'm writing to you before God, I do not lie. And then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was still unknown in person to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. They only were hearing it said, he who used to persecute us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy. And they glorified God because of me. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you caught it, in verse 11 and 12, Paul is going to elaborate on the point that he introduced back in the very first sentence of the letter, which we covered last week. And that point was this: the good news about Jesus, for which Paul had just sort of shown up in the southern regions of Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, and plant churches there after he preaches the gospel. He did all that, not because he came up with the idea, but because God had commissioned him. God had arrested him, literally, and pointed him in a new direction. And so in verses 11 and 12, he says, I'll have you know, brothers, the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. I didn't receive it from any man. I wasn't taught it. I received it through a revelation. If you read those chapters in the book of Acts that I recommend you did in the backstory this week, which is sort of a sequel to the Gospel of Luke, then you know how Paul came to be a follower of Jesus. At the end of Acts chapter 7, Stephen becomes the first martyr of the church. He is stoned in a barbaric fashion. And Stephen, before that, he preaches this long recap of Jewish history, which he says culminates in Jesus. And he ends the sermon, and this angry mob who believes that they're acting in righteousness, they stone him. And before they do, they lay their garments at Paul's feet, and he gives approval to what they're about to do. In ensuing chapters, Saul, that's his name before he becomes Paul, he begins orchestrating a systematic persecution of the church. And on his way to Syria, doesn't history go in cycles? He's confronted by a vision of Jesus himself, who asks Saul, why are you persecuting me? And in the course of the confrontation, Saul is converted to the lordship of Jesus, and in ensuing days, he changes his name to Paul for reasons no one quite knows. And so when Paul here in verse 12 says he received the message of Jesus through a revelation, what he means is that at least in part, that encounter was what came to form his understanding of the gospel. And that's part of his case to the Galatians about why they should believe that the message he's brought them is worth being accorded divine status. He has been put on the defensive, but he's not out to defend himself. He's defending himself for their sake. Why we read that passage in Matthew chapter 10 today where Jesus says, whoever receives me, whoever receives you receives me, and they shall not lose their reward. He is pressing for the authority of the gospel and his authority as one commissioned to preach it, because if they don't believe him, they will not receive their reward. And so he is explaining what accounts for the authority of the gospel, but at the same time, he shares that part to account for the part of his own story that he shares in the passage. And in verse 10, he's going to allude to where yours and my battle ultimately lies, first of all. That battle lies in the field of man. Where am I getting that? Look at verse 10 again. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. Now, that passage is sort of beginning in mid-thought. We kind of pick him up like he's already in the middle of something. If you were here last week, then you know that Paul is up against the wall, if you will, in the minds of the Galatian churches, because there are other people who have entered into their mix and begun teaching to them a variation of the gospel, which Paul says is no gospel at all. And at the same time, they're seeking to discredit his authority. These teachers, whoever they were, he never names them, they're competing with Paul's authority, and they're casting him as somebody who is just sort of a party hack that's come from Jerusalem, but that once he gets to Galatia, he goes rogue on the message and starts changing it so that he can ingratiate himself with a bunch of Gentiles who don't want to have anything to do with the law of Moses. They're casting him as such. He's provoked, that is, Paul is provoked to go on the offensive, but again, not to defend himself. It's to defend the pristine nature of the gospel for the own sake of the Galatians to whom he had preached it. And so he strikes out at these alternative teachers at the very same time that he's speaking pointedly to the Galatian believers. And he said back in chapter 1, verse 6, he says, I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting him, that is God the Father who called you by his grace. It's refreshing our memory of those fierce words that are directed both at those teachers and at the Galatian believers that helps us understand what Paul means in verse 10. He's telling the Galatians, look, those other teachers are saying to you that I'm out to ingratiate myself with you, that I'm out to win your approval. But if I'm out to tell you what you want to hear, why would I be speaking so pointedly to you and so fiercely to them? He's saying, if I'm out to win friends and influence people, I'm failing fairly badly right now by speaking so uproariously to you. If he's going to be faithful to the message and to the mandate he'd been given by God, then he can't make the praise of people his ultimate concern. And he's clearly showing that by how much in their face he's getting them. And he will do so again before we're done with the letter to Galatia. Where his personal comment goes, what his personal comment reveals, is where it gets personal with us. Why does verse 10 matter to us? Every human relationship, brothers and sisters, is in some sense a battlefield. Not that we are battling against each other all the time, far from it, but it is a battle for how we see one another and how we respond to one another. When we're young, everyone who is older is bigger, is smarter, is stronger than us. And so we have this natural and necessary authority over us from those who are bigger, smarter, and stronger. And in fact, we need them. And that's why we accede to them. And we can actually and will actually mature by learning to do what pleases those who are in authority over us. But what we're inferring from Paul's comment here is that true maturity is a matter of making the pleasure of God foremost in every human relationship. It has to be. His pleasure has to mean more than anyone else's does. To be sure, some people's pleasure reflect the very pleasure of God, but you can't assume that. Paul's not saying, hey, don't ever try to please somebody else. He's not saying that. Love, in part, is what it means to please them. He will elsewhere say he is becoming all things to all people. So he's not condemning the desire to please somebody else. But he is saying this. Don't ever try to please somebody else at the expense of pleasing God. Not your mother, not your father, not your siblings, not your spouse, not your boss, not your pastor. Never seek to please them if it's at the expense of pleasing God. Now, some have said, every relationship is motivated in any given moment by one of two things. Love or fear. you can speak to someone, you can do for someone out of a real desire to do them good. That is, out of love. And that may please them, and that's a good thing. But you can also speak to someone and do for someone only out of fear of what you will lose or experience if you don't. That's seeking to please them more so than just trying to please God. And if we want to be really complete here, fear doesn't only operate by way of seeking someone's approval. Fear can operate by trying to control someone. In that sense, you're not so much out to win their approval, so much as you're out to oblige their compliance, because you're afraid of not having control. And so you take control of another and you prey upon their fear of losing your approval. Paul is saying, in one sense or another, that living for another's approval is a zero-sum game when it comes to serving God. At the end of verse 10, he says, if I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. Which means he can't put man's approval above his calling if he's going to be a servant of Christ. But he's also saying implicitly he doesn't need the approval of man if he already has the approval of God that comes through Jesus. Now, I got to move on. It's only the first point. But the questions that you and I have to ask ourselves in light of this point are these. Why are you doing for someone whatever you might be doing for them? What's underneath that? What's driving that? Why do you have to do that if you think you do? And for those of you who don't so much live for another's approval, but for your control, why are you doing whatever you're doing to one another? What's driving that? What do you think you have to have? Our battle lies on the field of man. And unless you believe in the favor of God by grace, you will either fight to gain approval or to control somebody in the wake of it. But our battle lies on a second field too. And that battle is on the field of metrics. In verse 13, Paul's going to recount that part of his autobiography that makes his present moment to Galatians inexplicable apart from the authority of God. Look at verse 13 again. You've heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. Now, there's two things in those two verses. The fact that at one point Paul considered the church of Jesus to be worthy of extermination, and then at some other point he thought that that same church was worth dying for himself, is at least noteworthy. History, as you well know, is full of moments where there have been many people who have undergone a drastic transformation in outlook and who have displayed an astonishing fidelity to a cause. But brothers and sisters, as I was thinking about this week, there is something that distinguishes Paul in this case. There are those whose outlook has been changed and show forth their fidelity. And the way they show forth their fidelity is by dying through taking out their enemies. They may go down with the ship, but they're going to take a few down with them for the cause. Some people die in that way, and that's fidelity, and that's sincerity. And then there are others who will, in many forms or fashions, immolate themselves in order to shame their enemies, to show them that they're foolish, and so they will end themselves, if to make a point. But what Paul and others like him did, like their Lord, they were willing to die, not to take out their enemies or to shame their enemies, but to die for their enemies. That's what sets his willingness to die apart from others who show forth a sincerity. Paul was saying his life was worthy of that death. And if I may make sort of a side note application, brothers and sisters, it's this. That's one reason why it would be valid for you to pray for ISIS. because there are many in that cadre that believe that the extermination of the church is a righteous duty. If Paul went from a persecutor of the church to a proclaimer of the gospel by witnessing martyrs' death, would it be so foolish to pray for such that they might become preachers of the faith that they once tried to destroy? What's in view here is Paul's former murderous antipathy, which he himself considered a measure of his own fidelity to God. His zeal to vanquish the church was his metric. But he's bringing attention to another metric also, something the transformation of which may be even more remarkable. You heard that little litany of self-adulation there. He says he'd been advancing in Judaism. That is, he was excelling in his knowledge and the piety of faith. He said he was advancing beyond his peers. He's breaking from the pack. He's standing out. He's like the Phi Beta Kappa of the rabbinical school of the day. And he says also that he was extremely zealous for the traditions. He'd shown astounding command of the detailed and meticulous extrapolations of all the law. Now, why would he rattle all that off for the sake of the Galatians? Because all of that was what he once believed made him commendable. His zealous, outstanding advancement formed the metric of his existence. And he reproduces that same litany in Philippians 3, which was why we had Joy read that this morning. In Philippians 3, he said, as you heard, whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain him. He's conceding that when he met Jesus, with Christ comes an entirely different metric. The very thing that he thought made him commendable, he found was utterly vapid and insubstantial in comparison to what would really make him commendable to God. Until he could concede that there was nothing in him commendable, could he ever become commendable to God? That's the second field upon which the battle for faithfulness lies, the metric of what makes you commendable. Like perhaps no other time in human history, are there more metrics, more ways of measuring and evaluating things or people that we can measure how fast swimmers can go down a lane to the 1,000th of a second is just one in a billion examples of not only how precise we are in our metrics, but about how much we care about measuring things. A world full of measuring sticks can't help but accentuate the desire to be at the top end of each spectrum. Now, pause for a second. What's wrong with excelling? What's wrong with doing as best as you can and sometimes being the best in class? Anything wrong with that? Of course not. Unless the metric starts to mean more than just what it's measuring. Unless the metric that you won in this class means that that's what makes you acceptable to the world or to yourself or to the universe. William Dereschewitz wrote a provocative essay entitled, "Don't Send Your Kid to the Ivy League." Phew, okay, that'll save me some money. In it, he decried the metric of upward mobility and how it was having unintended and undesirable consequences among those being prepared for the most rigorous academic environments. It's a bit of a polemical essay, but he says this: our system of elite education manufactures young people who are smart and talented and driven, yes, but also anxious, timid, lost, with little intellectual curiosity and a stunted sense of purpose, trapped in a bubble of privilege, heading meekly in the same direction, great at what they're doing, but with no idea why they're doing it. You don't have to be preparing to go to the Ivy League to be caught in the same trap. Something gets lost when one lives for a metric imposed upon him or her. If there were any rational part to Robin Williams' fateful choice 2 weeks ago, it was that in his mind, his life had amounted to nothing worth enduring. in the end, his metric defined him as so far below the bell curve that at least in his mind, it justified not taking the test anymore. Paul is telling us there is only one metric that will keep your measuring of anything else from corroding you from the inside out. And it's not your metric. It's the measure of Christ's work on your behalf, His sacrifice, His blood. And like Paul, until you and I concede that there is nothing commendable in us, can we ever become commendable to God? If any of you happen to go all the way to the bottom of the pastoral backstory this week, then you saw a very enigmatic clip from a miniseries on German television called The Habsburg Tradition. It tells of what the German royals were like in that era, that 300-year reign of the Habsburgs in Germany. And it turns out that if you were a member of the royal family and you died, the funeral procession would bring your body to the royal crypt, which at that time would have been superintended by a priest. And a representative for you would knock upon the door, and the priest within would say, "Who goes there?" And the representative would then begin to rattle off any number of titles and achievements and names that were attached to that royal individual's name. And the priest would say, "Don't know you." And the representative would knock again, and the priest would say, "Who are you?" And the representative would come up with any other number of achievements, any other number of ways of referring to this royal person. And the priest within would say, "I don't know you." And this would go on and on until finally the representative would knock on the door, and the priest would say, "Who goes there?" And the representative would say, "A poor sinner." And the priest would say, "You may enter. You may find your rest." And then the door would open, and that man or woman would be laid to rest. Brothers and sisters, you and I have to be shorn of all that we think that make us commendable so that we might find a rest in God, so that our striving can be in a commendable way. I ask by way of rhetorical device, if you lost everything today, if everything you had and worked for tanked or was taken away, what would your view of God be? What would you believe about Him? What would you believe about the promise of His Son? The battle for faithfulness lies on the field of metrics. Last point. It lies on the field of men, it lies on the field of metrics, but the battle for our own faithfulness also lies on the field of meaning. The word meaning implies purpose, reason for being. In our day, people get meaning from all sorts of places and people. People will believe that meaning is created. It's what you do. There's nothing outside the universe, so it's all up to you. There are others who believe that meaning derives from something outside themselves. In whichever case, one way that people find meaning is to see their lives as part of a story, such that our lives are bigger than any given moment because that moment is part of a larger narrative. And in verse 15, Paul will end his recap of his former life before he'd met Christ by saying this: "When He who had set me apart before I was born and who called me by His grace was pleased to reveal His Son to me in order that I might preach Him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone." And then Paul will go on and share several more details of what it was like following his conversion. And he did all that to underscore to the Galatians just how independent he'd been of the influence of the Jerusalem church early on. And to us, those details may be insignificant, and maybe they are. But when Paul says, "When He who set me apart before I was born and who called me by His grace," he's placing himself in a story over which he had no control. And it's that larger story that accounts for how he'd been literally stopped in his tracks while on the way to end the church. How he had come to that southern region of Asia Minor to bring a bizarre yet oddly attractive message of hope. What he's doing is finding meaning in a story that oversees every given moment. There are 525,600 minutes in a year, as the song goes. And for most of those minutes, we are only thinking about what is right under our nose. Just the minute that we're presently experiencing. But inevitably, moments are going to come when we are forced to face a larger reality than our given moment. And in those moments, we are faced with a choice. Are we going to believe that our lives are unwitnessed, alone, left to ourselves and those around us, and yet still very exposed? Or are we seen? Are we known? Are we surrounded? And if we are seen and fully known, including all the parts that we wish nobody would ever see or know, what hope have we that we could ever be embraced on the way our story has unfolded? In what might be something even ancillary to Paul's point, he's saying to them, he's saying to us, this life has meaning because it's bound up with the God who gave it meaning. And nothing could more prove that meaning than God sending one to die for people who had sought to find their own meaning apart from its source. That's the same God who could watch a man give approval to and participate in executions of his beloved, but later, by grace, call that murderer to himself and then turn him into a preacher. Brothers and sisters, if God can forgive, redeem, and use one who'd murdered the faithful, can he not do the same for those who think too much of man? Who worry so much about whether they matter that they forget how much Jesus proves that they do. Who are tempted to think that their meaning is ultimately dependent upon themselves. Men, metrics, and meaning are pretty much where we will find every struggle in our life from now until the day we die. But it will be the grace of God in Jesus that will help us walk into that field with courage and to carry the day. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, you have said so much and done more. And we need a fresh sense of its truth, not just in word, but in the power of your Spirit, that we might face those we know and face the moments and the way we think of ourselves and what define us and face the story that we find ourselves in, that we might do so with grace, the grace you've shown, and the grace that frees us to love and to walk with peace. Help us. Teach us. Comfort us. In Jesus' name, amen.